Mr. Reagan, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, John.
You may proceed.
I have 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court and counsel. This appeal is about whether or not Anthony Swindle got a fair trial in which he was convicted of multiple counts. And it also raises an issue with regard to sentencing. But with regard to the fair trial contention, our points are, number one, that the jury was not instructed properly with regard to the offense of sex trafficking of a minor. Number two, that his counsel at trial denied the ability to adequately cross-examine a witness by the misapplication of the rape shield statute, which was subject to pretrial proceedings, for which I got an order from the court, which I contend was violated and changed in the middle of trial. Number three, we're alleging that there was prosecutorial misconduct with regard to statements made by the prosecutor in opening that they knew were false and were absolutely inflammatory. Number four, there was denial of that the court misapplied the rules of evidence when it came to the admission of a defendant's or a party's statement, and that it allowed essentially people to provide their opinions about what they thought somebody said, as opposed to making the state prove or show the actual statement that I think the hearsay exception under 27801 actually authorizes. So, going back in order, the issue with regard to statutory construction, jury instructions deals with the sex trafficking statute that states that a person must knowingly engage in conduct with regard to a minor. And in that statutory scheme, a minor is defined as a person 12 to 16 in this case. So the issue is, does a person need to know that or have reason to know that? I think I think there's three ways to look at it. One is a totally subjective way, which I think is what the statute compels. Subjective standard is you have to prove that this person knew that factor, that the person was a minor. Secondly, there could be an objective standard, which is a reasonable person should have known. And then thirdly, there's a strict liability standard, which applies in connection with other statutes, which says it doesn't matter whether you knew it or not. If the person is a certain age, then you're guilty of the offense. You don't have to know they were a minor.
What's the importance of the age of the minor? Does it matter?
It affects the penalty.
So it goes to the penalty.
Yes, it affects the penalty. It makes it a more severe penalty, which I think, to me, that's a different crime. If the penalty's greater, then it's a different crime.
The younger the victim, the more serious the crime.
Yes, Your Honor. So the question is here: what does that word "knowingly" mean in this statute? And I got to tell you, we were the first trial on the issue on this statute in district court in Douglas County. So the process of coming up with jury instructions based upon in my opinion, ridiculously convoluted, poorly drafted statute was quite a chore. I don't even remember if all that stuff was on the record. Probably was.
We spent more time. Do you know where the statute came from?
Do I know where it came from?
Is it borrowed from another state or?
I really don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I do know that the word "knowingly" is in the statute, that's the real issue in this case. And it's not a matter of mens rea. The state's brief really talks more about that. It's not a matter of can the state make it a strict liability crime, which I would tell you that they have now. They have, after the trial, the legislature amended the statute to basically say you don't have to know. It is not a defense that a person did not know the age of the victim in the case.
But the time of trial, it's statutory rape cases. Is knowingly part of the jury instruction?
No, but it says
in the statute,
In statutory rape cases, the word knowingly is not in the statute. So, you know, a person has to subject a person to sexual contact or penetration, and that person has to be under a certain age, period.
So you offered a jury instruction.
I did, Your Honor. It's in my brief, and I guess as I'm sitting here looking at stuff, I don't know that I can tell you exactly, but it is in the record. It's in the Bill of Exceptions and in the transcript, I believe.
And the judge gave a different one.
Yes.
What was wrong with the one that the judge gave?
The one the judge gave did not require the state to prove that Mr. Swindle knew the age of the victim. That's the issue in the case. So the question is, do you need to know when you're charged with doing something to a minor that carries an enhanced penalty, do you need to know that that person is a minor? And under the statutory scheme at the time, the word knowingly said you had to. To me, that's what it means. I think in my brief, I've cited several cases, including those from the United States Supreme Court, that say that courts ordinarily read a phrase in a criminal statute that introduces the elements of a crime with the word knowingly as applying that word to each element of the offense. That's U.S. versus Excitement video. It's in my brief. And
have other courts addressed this similar statute?
No. Well, I don't know. I mean, the only other case that I saw that was one that the state cited from Louisiana, State versus Sims, but that's not even remotely on point. That's a statute which complies, which basically is what our current statute is, which is they made it a strict liability crime. They made it a crime that did not require knowingly. That's what this Louisiana's statutory scheme required. So it doesn't. It's about mens rea. It's not about statutory construction. That's what this is about, statutory construction. And I think we can all agree that a criminal statute must be strictly construed. There's no doubt about that. And so that's our argument with regard to the jury instruction on the issue of whether Mr. Swindle needed to knowingly be aware of the age of this person. And our jury instruction that was refused. We were also denied the right to cross-examine the witness on her credibility. The rape shield statute says the purpose of that is to say you can't get into somebody's sexual history or promiscuity in an effort to shame them or in an effort to paint them in a way that you can use to infer something to a jury. That's not what we did. I filed a motion, as required by 27.412, and raised the issue about what we wanted to talk about. And in his pretrial order, Judge Okepka wrote, in the manner at bar, evidence of the victim's prior false claims of rape are relevant to demonstrate her credibility as a witness and may leave the jury with a significantly different impression of her credibility as a witness. Basically following this court's decision in State versus LaVallure, which says that the fact that it's about sex isn't the issue under the rape shield statute. It's the way you're using it that is the issue. If you're using it to say, hey, that person is prone to having sex, I've never been in a situation where I've tried to do that, but that's not what we were doing. We were trying to show...
It was addressing, in maybe not applicable to this case, an issue perhaps of consent.
No, we were addressing an issue... Well, the rape shield statute's intended for that. My purpose was to address an issue of credibility.
Yes.
This, you know, even the witness herself said I blew things out of proportion. My offer of proof talked was medical records from her and her mother, statements about her proclivity to do that in similar situations to what we were dealing with in this trial. To be perfectly blunt, the issue is, was she making up a story or blowing it out of proportion? And was the type of questioning that I wanted to get into, which was her prior history of doing that, something that I should have been able to question her about, even though it touched on sex? That's not sex.
So when an issue of credibility bumps headlong into the rape shield statute, which one trumps?
Well, I think that every case is different, but in this case, the issue of credibility trumps because it doesn't really infringe on it. It didn't really bump into the rape shield statute. So I don't know that I can answer that question, but other than to say that I don't think there isn't any direct bumping into. That's why I raised the issue pre-trial, and Judge Otemkin made his ruling that I planned my trial strategy on.
What changed in the trial?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I mean,
why did the judge change his ruling?
Well, I don't think there's anything in the record that would tell us that. So I would just say that the judge changed his mind, I guess.
We review this for an abuse of discretion, is that correct?
Yes, you review this for abuse of discretion, right, in this instance.
Is there an instruction that you would say is an incorrect statement of the law?
Not on this issue. We did not ask for an instruction. I mean, how could you ask for instruction on something that didn't happen?
Is there a constitutional issue there?
Well, I did not. And the state points out that I did not brief the question of constitutional deprivation of a confrontation right in this. But I think that we don't need to go there. It's a statutory issue. The statute says, and this court's decision in State versus La Velour confirms, that there are reasons to get into issues such as this that are not barred by the rape shield statute. And this was one of them. That's our position.
Was it even an issue under that statute?
No, I don't think it was prohibited by the rape shield statute, because, and that's what Judge Otemkin wrote in his pretrial ruling.
Initially, yes.
Right.
The district court seemed to say that he was not going to allow you to pursue your questions about credibility because there was no evidence to support the fact that the alleged victim had made false claims in the past.
Well, I think that's nonsensical, to be perfectly honest with you. How can there be evidence if I can't ask the question? That was the specific issue in State versus La Velour, which was the evidence at issue was produced from cross-examining the witness, was introduced by cross-examining the witness, the trial court denied it, this court reversed it. So there is no evidence because I wasn't allowed to present it. So the evidence, and I looked at this before, this is, you know, I mean, I had subpoenaed the mother in the case. It's not in the transcript, though, so I mean, I guess it's not part of the record, but I would just point out that I wasn't allowed to present the evidence. So to me, that was a shocking way of dealing with the predicament at the time, to say, well, you have no evidence, because I'm like, well, you're not letting me present the evidence, so of course there's no evidence.
There was no stream coming in, for example, of a prior inconsistent statement or something that might have given you a different handle.
No, I mean, I didn't have a prior, prior sworn testimony to deposition or something like that. No, I did not have that. This was something that, you know, when you're trying a case, it's always a good idea, from my point of view, to not tell the other side exactly what you have planned. So I didn't think that
you were expecting to be able to do this on cross.
Yes, Your Honor, and based on the pretrial order. So when I was stopped, I was probably taken aback. I was taken aback, but I wasn't allowed to present the evidence. That's why it's not in the record. The other issue that I want to raise is the prosecutorial misconduct issue, which is, I mean, I'll just briefly say there's no possible way that the prosecutor can say that they were surprised by this. They said they had this sexual assault nurse report that said that totally contradicted their claim in opening statement, and they knew from her prior testimony at a deposition that she had recanted her statement about having a gun. In fact, they even elicited at trial that she lied about it. So, I mean, you can't let them, anybody say an opening statement, whatever they want, and then say, we didn't prove it, so it doesn't really matter.
This was a willful, intentional violation of the
probable question.
Well, I don't know where the communication between the facts and the brain broke down, but it broke down somewhere. I don't know where it broke down.
What is the standard for statements made in opening that are not later confirmed by the evidence?
Well, I think that that goes to the issue of harmless error, which I, you know, I think that the question is, this court in State versus Williams, Robert Williams with 253 Nebraska, 111, basically said that there's no reasonable possibility that it had an impact on the jury.
My question was a little different. My question was, you know, not every time that a lawyer makes a statement in opening that's not later confirmed by the evidence is it misconduct. So what makes it misconduct?
What makes it misconduct in this case is the inflammatory nature of it, the fact that that was designed clearly, and could only be designed clearly to portray Mr. Swindle as some type of gun-toting pervert, basically. And, I mean, I think that branding somebody with characteristics or conduct that you know isn't true in opening statement can't be a more clear case of being prejudiced by it. The last thing, I'm kind of getting into my rebuttal time, but I'll just say briefly, I mean, the other issue is, what is the statement under the hearsay exception rule? It's not, "Oh, I think this is what I heard him say. This is the impression I got from listening to this person." All your prior decisions on that have dealt with, like, emails, letters, records. A statement is a statement. It's what I said. It's not your version of what I said, or your impression of what kind of conclusion you reached based upon what I said. It's what I said. It's what I wrote. And in this case, the state was allowed to basically, I mean, they're repeatedly questioned, what was your impression from that? So that's not a hearsay exception. That's not a statement of a party that's accepted by
the
hearsay.
The argument is, it has to be verbatim, but what's your mindset?
Yes. I think it has to be a statement. I mean, that's the whole point of the exception of the hearsay rule. It doesn't open the door to letting people say, "Well, here's what I heard." I mean, that totally defeats the purpose of it. You make an exception to a pretty ironclad rule, then the rule is, and there's no discretion. This isn't a discretionary thing. This court repeatedly has said, when there's no discretion involved, then an error is an error. So a statement's not a statement, unless it's a statement. I mean, I don't know how much more I can say. So, but those would be, I'm going to save, I guess, any other comments for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Parks, good morning to you.
Good morning. Please report. My name is Glenn Parks. I'm here on behalf of the people of Nebraska in this appeal of the conviction of Anthony Swindle. I want to begin by first time of error, this jury instruction about whether the knowledge that the minor victim is in fact a minor is an element of the crime of sex trafficking of a minor. I first want to draw the court's attention to, however, a case of this court from 3 years ago, State versus Armaghost, 291 MLB 117. This is not in my brief. I apologize for that. I was preparing for oral argument. One of my colleagues alerted me to this. And I do think, on the first time of error, this may be dispositive in any ruling that you make regarding the question of the elements. The procedural posture of Armaghost is very similar to what we have here. It's an appeal from a conviction. One of the assignments of error is that there was a submitted proposed jury instruction that wasn't submitted to the jury about the articulation, a further articulation of one of the elements of the crime. This court, in a relatively short opinion, repeatedly said giving instructions in the language of the statute is the right thing to do. Let me remind this court that in the case at hand, jury instruction number 6 talked about elements of the crimes, including sex trafficking of minor, of this third count. Basically, it was just, did the defendant commit this crime, and was the minor victim under 16? Then in jury instruction number 7, some definitions, all the relevant definitions were there, including a cut and paste of exact word-for-word quote from the definition of sex trafficking of a minor, including the word knowingly and the minor and this whole one. So the jury had the language of the statute. It cannot be misleading, it can't be a misstatement of the law to give the jury that exact wording. And in this case, repeatedly, it says giving instructions to the jury is proper for the court to describe the offense. And this court also even talked about why that was the case. This principle simplifies the process of preparing jury instructions. It provides certainty for trial courts concerning the question whether the essential elements of the offense have been given to the jury. So, I spent most of my time, I was frankly blinded by the fascinating issue of whether knowledge of age is an element of the crime. If in fact you find my brief persuasive, and it's not, then of course the proposed jury instruction is not an accurate statement of the law, therefore of course not submitting it to the jury would not have been an error.
Could you clarify that? Now you're saying knowledge of age is not an element.
Technically, the question I think is, to be convicted of the crime of sex trafficking of a minor, does the defendant have to know that the minor victim was in fact a minor? The minor is defined as someone under 18.
And the question is and in the statute has the word knowingly.
Yeah, so
and what was the object of it knowingly? Knowing what?
Right. So sex trafficking of a minor is when a person knowingly, and there's I think six verbs there, harboring, transporting, providing, obtaining, or attempting to, in the verbs again, a minor for the purposes of, and then there's three qualifying purposes. One thing
is it like, is it knowingly harboring?
Right. So knowingly, obviously, it's an
adverb. Knowingly qualifies each of those on the list with equal force. Is that your argument?
I certainly would say knowingly modifies each of the verbs, doing the act. There's also a second level of, or a second stage, I guess, of a mens rea in this statute, in that it has to be for a certain purpose. It has to be for the purpose of that minor engaging in X, Y, or Z. Since we're on this, let me just make this quick point. The language of sex trafficking of an adult, so of someone who's not a minor, is exactly the same, except, of course, instead of saying sex trafficking is, it says sex trafficking of a minor, and it substitutes out the word minor for a person over the age of 18, or 18 or older. So it seems to me that is distinguishing these two crimes, but knowingly is used exactly the same way, and it would be ludicrous to say that not knowing for a defense in a prosecution of sex trafficking proper, to say, well, I didn't know that the person was 18 years or age or older. That would never be a defense. And so in the exact wording of the next statute, I would propose that knowing that the victim was a minor is more like our statutory rape and our sexual assault of a child jurisprudence.
So what's strict liability? I was going to say that their argument is strict liability. The defendant engages in these certain activities, and if the victim happens to be a minor, whether or not the defendant knew of it.
That's correct.
Is that your position?
That is our position. It's strict liability vis-a-vis knowledge of the age of the victim.
I'm sorry, you said knowledge of the age is not an element. So
I'm sorry, knowledge of
the... Strict liability if, in fact, the victim just happens to be a minor.
Right, it's strict liability concerning this question. Of course, they have to know that they're transporting or harboring. That's a knowledge element, but the knowledge element is not about the age. So strict liability is to that specific.
So enjoying the act, no matter how old the age of the victim is, it's illegal.
Right. How old they appear, even if they stated, oh, like I'm 20 years old, which happened in this case, that's irrelevant to whether you have committed this crime.
So the age of the victim is established to be under 18 or under 16, then the penalty is different than if the person was over, the victim was over 18.
Well, it's not even a crime, actually, if the person, well, this gets a little complicated. Technically, yes. I'm pretty sure this court would acknowledge that in the LD 289 last year, they added without consent to the sex trafficking of an adult. It's universally understood that sex trafficking of an adult has to be some forced product coercion without consent. Otherwise, it's just prostitution and pandering exactly the same elements as sex trafficking of an adult. So, as it was worded then, that this is true, that the only difference in that it's an enhanced penalty if it's 18, but I think the actual law, and as it states now, is that there has to be without consent. So, it's actually a new crime. In this case, there is abundant evidence that there was without consent. There was force, physical force, there was containment.
At trial.
But that's not an element of sex trafficking of a minor. That was not necessary.
I really think
it's contextual. The appellate in his reply brief responded. I talked about this excitement video and the distinction that's made there between possessor of child pornography and the producer of child pornography. The former, it has to be proven that they understood that the age. The second, the producer of pornography has a reasonable opportunity to observe and understands. We as a society, think we can charge them with knowledge of the age. The appellate in his reply brief did cite a 2009 U.S. Supreme Court opinion, Flores, which mitigates that a bit. I would like to draw the court's attention to Justice Alito's concurrence in that opinion. He is kind of pushing back a little bit on the majority opinion, saying it's the plain language of English, so what's the plain meaning? So this is answering your question on does it always only modify a verb? And I think it's persuasive there that it really depends on the context. Again, let me just point out that the U.S. Supreme Court, they're talking about sexual interpretation. This court is not, it's not binding authority, of course. This court gets to decide what the laws of Nebraska are. In the context, I think sometimes direct objects of verbs could be intentional. But I think in this context, looking at other statutes that are similar to it, including the sex trafficking of an adult, but also other sex crimes against crimes of a sexual nature against minors, this court has held in Vickers and the other cases I've cited, that even though it's not clear in the statute, it neither requires knowledge that the minor is a minor, nor does it explicitly say that's not an element. In this case, this court has held and has affirmed it, or has restated it several times, that knowledge that the victim is a minor is not required. So this seems like a very similar criminal statute to that. So I think, in fact, the weight of the persuasive authority and the jurisprudence of this court is that knowledge that the person is a minor is not an element of sex trafficking of a minor. But again, back to Armagos, even if, in fact, this court says that that language entails an element of knowledge of the minor, that language has been given to the jury, and I believe this court made sort of a public policy decision to encourage courts to use the language of the law and not to give a lot of colored commentary in jury instructions and further explaining elements to the crime outside the language of the statute.
How does that proposition that it's prudent to follow the language of the statute, what do you take from that with respect to a proposal to add another instruction?
Right, so that's exactly, precisely what happened in Armagos. The court made, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, but the court said even arguing that the defendant or the appellant was correct.
Even if the defendant tendered a correct.
Exactly, correct. Yeah, because of course that's the first question, right? Is the proposed jury instruction an accurate statement of law? Even if it is, using for a court to use the language of the statute, instruction number three, even if the appellant was right, this is quoting from Armagos, instruction number three, use the language of the statute was sufficient to describe the elements of the crime charge. So even granted, if for the sake of argument, this court granted the appellant's point. So I think in this case, again, that's I think the evidence and the the evidence, but the analysis really favors heavily the holding that knowledge that the victim is a minor is not an element of the crime. It seems to me, even if that was your holding, this still wouldn't be an error, reversible error. If there are no more questions on that, I'll move on to a few other things that were said. One thing I very much want to make clear regarding both the 412, the rape shield assignment of error, and the hearsay assignment of error, I believe at trial, when these objections were made, it was never made clear to the court the basis that is now being brought before by appellant for the objections. At one point, when the statement of the defendant was going to be summarized, I'll concede that it wasn't an exact quote, that it was a summary, someone's memory of a summary of what the defendant had said, the objection was hearsay. And I think we can probably presume that the judge thought, well, no, this is actually not hearsay because it's a statement of the party defendant. And so it was overruled. If at that point the defendant's attorney could have articulated, sidebar, could have articulated maybe, well, my point is that this isn't an exact quote, this is more of a paraphrase, that could have been addressed. I don't even know if this court needs to get into those nuances because we can't charge the trial court with abuse of discretion when he was not even given the chance to understand the basis, this little bit of a unique basis for the hearsay exception. So,
the hearsay rule require a verbatim recitation of what the defendant said?
I don't think it could possibly do that because we're talking about I think it would go to the weight and perhaps the credibility of the witness. If it's very much, well, I can't remember, but they kind of said something sort of like this, I imagine the jury would, and as a defense attorney, I think I would say, well, this wasn't an exact quote, how much can we trust this person? But it's still the statement, or the it was something that the defendant said, and that's not hearsay, according to our evidence rules. So, I don't think, I mean, it would be very cumbersome, and it's certainly other than the practice of the state, to demand an exact quote from a defendant. And again, if that was the point, I think it should have been brought, if that was the basis of the objection, it should have been brought to the court's decision that that was the basis of the
hearsay. What is your view? Let's say a witness says something to the effect, in response to the question, is what was your understanding at that point in time?
Right.
And the answer will or will not be hearsay?
Well, I think if the objection is hearsay, and there's no further discussion, and the judge says overruled, I don't think that can be abuse of discretion because this is in a category of a statement of the defendant. If, in fact, it was objection hearsay, this is not a statement, this is a paraphrase or someone's vague recollection.
But you don't know what your question, what the answer might be.
Right. Well,
somebody told me something, or I saw it.
Are you asking if the prosecution's question is too big?
Yes.
Like, what was your general recollection? That may be, again, I would think we would need to articulate to the judge the basis of that. But I think it would be proper for a judge to say, look, you need to be a bit more specific about the question. I think that would be proper. But it can't be an abuse of discretion, right, if the judge wasn't even given that. The same problem comes with the rape shield. Indeed, there was a motion to present 412 evidence. The judge, I thought, gave a very balanced, and I would agree, as the state, I would agree with both points he makes, that issues of credibility are definitely legitimate, and he can explore that, issues of promiscuity or not. And so that was the basis, that was the order coming in. I feel like during the appellant's argument, there was an understanding that the judge changed his mind. I don't believe that's at all the case. The objections that came were regarding the minor witness's statement on direct for the prosecution, saying that she lied about her age. She said she was 20. Well, why did you say you were 20? Well, because when I run away, I go with guys, and there's sort of this implication where we're dipping into 412 evidence, right? So, of course, the prosecutor didn't further that. The defense wanted to follow up on that, which I think is okay maybe she is a liar. So that this might affect the credibility in front of the jury. The subject matter of the order was about her supposed proclivity to lie when she got back home after running away, lying about rape, which is of course a very relevant credibility issue, and she's the key witness in this trial on sexual assault of a child. However, when it came up, the objection, they had a sidebar, and the defense lawyer said, what I want to do right now, this is all I want to do, he says this twice, all I want to do is talk about her tendency to run away and to get hitchhiked. And the judge said, aren't you going to ask about the, I thought you were going to get into the lying about the age. And instead of clarifying it, the defense advocate said, just give us a ruling. And of course he overruled, because that's not relevant. And perhaps he was also, it isn't clear if it was irrelevant, if he was sustaining the relevance objection or the 412 was probably the relevant one. So,
but later, didn't the defense counsel more directly try to go into the subject of whether there had been prior false claims of rape? And didn't the district court say something about, well, we need evidence to support this before I'm going to allow you to go into that?
I'm sorry, can you read that back again? The asking for the evidence of, yeah.
I can try. Later, there was a line of questioning that didn't go to just running away. It went to, have there been prior occasions in which there, after the alleged victim has run away, that she made false claims of rape.
Is that asking for an offer of proof?
There was an offer of proof in this. This was after, so she testifies on a Friday, so the next Monday, they had an offer of proof. I honestly don't recall that particular exchange. That wasn't in the appellant's brief. And I don't remember this particular exchange. I apologize.
But do you recall a point at which the district court seemed to indicate that the defense counsel needed evidence of prior false claims of rape and wouldn't let him go into that subject without such evidence?
I do not remember that.
Do you have a position on whether that would be proper if we assume that that occurred?
I do think that there needs to be some basis. So of course, the defense advocate can't randomly ask about things. So there needs to be some basis. I think that was the trial judge in his order said that was certainly a legitimate area of inquiry if it goes to the credibility, which I think he delineated the parameters of the 412. Again, I think Judge Stacey was asking who wins if the credibility and 412 are at odds. I think the appellant is right. We didn't really have to make that decision in this case. So he laid out for that. I do think there needs to be some basis of... there has to be some basis for this.
And was that basis lacking in this case?
I don't think so. I think there was evidence in pretrial evidence that she had lied about these things. Okay, 2 minutes time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we have time for rebuttal? 2 minutes and 9 seconds. 2 minutes and 9 seconds, Mr. Ray.
Thank you. Just a couple of things. I'm not familiar with the decision the counsel brought up, Armagas. I would point out that in this instance, instruction number 7 does define knowingly, so it goes beyond the statute in instructing the jury. It says knowingly means with knowledge or perception of the facts requisite to make up the crime, which is really just gibberish. It's just a circular instruction. It doesn't really say anything. It doesn't say anything. So our instruction, which is in the Bill of Exceptions, asks the court to define what knowingly means. and not just say knowingly means what I already said. So, but I don't know, I guess I can't really comment on how this Armagas case fits in. With regard to the rape shield issue, 27412, that's why we have a pretrial proceeding, so that, this doesn't come up in the middle of court, in the middle of the trial, and so people can plan how they're going to try their case. So you have to file a motion, you have to give notice of it in an adequate time prior to trial, you have to have a hearing on it, and after, that's what I did, and therefore, again, being told in the middle of trial, in my view, our contention would be in the middle of trial that I'm going to change the ruling. I'm not going to let you get into that.
Was that conflated with the runaway issue?
Well,
the runaway, the prior of false report?
Possibly. I mean, they kind of go together. I mean, the issue that I intended to get into, that my pretrial motion talked about, was when this person runs away and gets in trouble for running away, they come up with a lie, a deceitful story, to explain or excuse their behavior or get out of trouble. So I appreciate that. Unless there's any other questions, I think my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for today. Or is adjourned if you are excused.